Hi everyone, my name is David Palmer. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. So for the original manuscript, it's the bottom of 42, the very last, the paragraph that starts at the very bottom. When dealing with such a person, you had better use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There is no arousing any prejudice he may have against certain theological terms and conceptions about which he may already be confused. Don't raise such issues no matter what your own convictions are. You know, I remember one time I was invited to speak at this Oxford House or something like that. It was a meeting down in Philadelphia, and I went down to the meeting, and the guy who had invited me is a good friend of mine, Anthony, and he actually spoke here, and I went down, and I just gave a pitch based upon where I was at the time. You know, like sometimes when you're at some place special, right, and you want to talk about that special place. And when I was done, there was at best a smattering of applause. Right? They kind of looked at me like, oh, where did he come from? And Anthony Lair told me, he goes, what were you talking about? You know, like, these guys are like in day 34. You know, they're direct out of the drunk tank, you know. And they wanted to hear about, you know, setting fire to cops and alcoholism and everything else. But I have been talking about spiritual awakenings and traveling down the fourth column in the big book. And they had no, what the hell is a fourth column? They didn't know what a fourth column was. So the idea that when I'm going to kind of come at you and try to make a presentation to you about, like, what has happened to me and what has happened to the men and women who all came before me and who are going down this journey with me, it's about the idea that we can relate on all levels. You know, we can relate in the simplest terms that, you know, I take for granted today a lot of times. You know, I forget, unless I think about it, what it was like when waking up and just knowing that I was a failure at everything that I did. You know, waking up in the horror, like, my life probably couldn't get much worse unless the cops come through the door, you know. That feeling like, you know, I would never find someone to be with because I was not worthy of that. You know, the idea that I was being, run ragged by something that I didn't even know what it looked like. I just knew that I couldn't stop drinking, you know. The great gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is that do the work, and you can spend some time away from that, right? How cool is that? But it's never too far removed. I have this, I've been very fortunate, certainly in the last 6 months of working with a bunch of new guys, and in that place, I get to see the insanity that comes back, and it's the insanity is that close lie, right? The lie that I today. Am aware of in my life is always the lie that has learned to adapt to my recovery, right? It knows, oh, well, Dave ain't going to fall for that, so I'm going to tell him this. You know, he knows that they're not really laughing at him anymore, probably, right? But he will get upset if this happens. So as soon as that happens, he will. You know, I'll make sure he doesn't let that go. It'll remind him of something. You know. The lie that I have today is the evolved lie, the lie that has kind of faced a lot of inventory, the lie that has faced a lot of times where I've sat down and, you know, working with others or with my sponsor and talked about something, you know, and been shown just how absurd something is. You know, one of the biggest issues I've ever had, and I've come to realize it over the years, was pride, right? No matter how much work I did, I always thought I was better than somebody somewhere, you know. And if you weren't nearby, I'd go find you, you know. I just had to be. There was something about me that I just had to feel better than I felt, and making you less than, even if I didn't say that, but making you less than was an important part of kind of who I thought I was, you know. And I would uncover this inventory, nightly reviews, I'd uncover it, and I'd work toward it. And the great thing about the inventory process is that when I actually take a look at it, right, I don't have to make an amends for what has happened, but I can understand where I'm broken with God, work on that through prayer and meditation, and have that removed so I won't have that thing happen repeatedly. Isn't it depressing when you're doing inventory and you go, yeah, I'm mad at Bob. He said something in a meeting about me, and I hate him. You know? And then, you know, like a month later, you go, well, I'm mad at Sally. She said the same goddamn thing as that Bob, and I hate her. Right? I seek to find why they bother me. why don't I believe God has given me a perfect life? Why can't I wrap my hands around the idea that this whole thing has been elegant from day one? Handcuffs were elegant. They were needed at the time. Restraints were elegant. They were needed at the time, right? The loss of loved ones, you know, these are things that just happen in life. And this whole idea, right, that I don't believe this is what causes me problems. So, you know, when I'm new, I'm freshly out of the booby hatch, you know, when I'm freshly, you know, separated from the one thing that might actually solve my problem, alcohol, my disease does not need to polish up the lie machine because I'm still believing all the other lies, you know? And that's why when I sit down with the new guy today, I got to be real simple about this. What does alcoholism look like, you know, in the most basic and simple way? What is it that keeps me picking up the bottle against my will, right? And it's an interesting process because, you know, when I roll through the store, I used to hate people who would you know, speak about God from the podium. I want to hear the story about how you went to prison. You know, I want to hear the story about how you rolled the car over 7 times and still held on to your beer. You know, I want to hear the story about how you were the guy who drilled a hole in the firewall of your car, ran a tube in underneath your steering wheel, and filled your windshield washer container with scotch, and would just press the thing and drink as you went down the road. I've heard that from podiums. But God forbid you talked about God. That was so annoying. What the hell are you wasting my time for? I'm not getting with you, sheep. Right? But freedom never came until I started to slowly but surely set aside those little things. But it was on day one that, God forbid, you talked about God. I'm out of here. Right? And if you did, you better put it in simple terms, because I'm going to come up with some real reasons why it's not going to work for me. Your prospect may belong to a religious denomination. His religious education and training may be far superior to yours. In that case, he is going to wonder how you can add anything to what he already knows. But he will be curious to learn why his own religious convictions have not worked, and yours have given you victory. He may be an example of the truth that faith alone is insufficient. To be vital, faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. You know, it's funny. I want to say it's in the doctor's opinion. Between the first and the second letter, let me find the page. So the bottom of XXIV, which is the part that Bill wrote underneath Very Truly Yours, William D. Silkworth, the last paragraph begins with, though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as altruistic plane. Now, there was a time where, you know, I mean, I had read that 100 times, right? Never gave it any more thought. And I started to think about what he meant there. I started to ask myself, like, what does he mean by spiritual and altruistic? See, I never really thought about it. Those are words I wasn't involved with, right? I wasn't altruistic and I wasn't spiritual, so we don't need to understand them, right? We can just, you know, if it's not selfish and self-centered, then I don't really care about it. And when I started to think about what that actually meant, I suddenly realized that spiritual means that I am willing to give of myself, and altruistic means I expect no one to ever know about it, nor should I ever receive, you know, a welcoming hand or a thank you, right? What happens if you could take an action that no one would ever know about, right? And change other lives? Would you do it? Do you require to be recognized for it? I had a sponsor in another fellowship. I was in my second year coming back, so it was 2006. And she said to me, I said, I'm having a hard time with this. She goes, well, have you ever done any esteemable acts? I said, well, what do I get out of that? And she's like, no, she goes, I'm serious. She goes, your job now, and you're to report back to me only on whether or not you were able to accomplish, is to do 3 esteemable acts every single day, but it doesn't count if anybody knows you did it. I said, that's stupid. That's just moronic. And she goes, no, seriously, think about it. I said, well, you know, I'm thinking like I have to, like, you know, do something wonderful, like, you know, paint an old lady's porch or, you know, give something. She goes, no, you can literally leave a pen, you know, at a bank you know, where you deposit checks. Because, I mean, how many times have you gone and like, oh, crap, there's no pen here, right? Same thing at the post office. You can leave a pen somewhere. You can go. And I ended up getting in the habit of, well, I can't talk about it, come to think of it. But I get in the habit of.
It's ruined now.
I didn't mention it. But I got into the routine. I actually found, she didn't say that had to be different things every day. And I had a conversation with her about this. But she said, go out and do things. And here's the funny thing. I found a series of things I could do and get away with it. And that whole mental process, I don't think that it changed anybody's life, right? But that whole mental process of going from what about me to what about somebody else. Now that was interesting because that kind of change that occurred took a while. It probably took 6 to 9 weeks of like constantly trying to, you know, please her to do the right thing, right, and just be part of this. But the actual, it's like when you first time you go out running. I don't know if here is ever like anybody here has ever decided to go back to running after being fat and stupid like me, like years after not having a run, and like you get like down to the end of the block and you go, why did I do this? Right, but if you stay with it 6 or 9 weeks later, you're putting a mile and a half, 2 miles, 4 miles, whatever it is, in, right? And it feels kind of natural at that point. Well, that's what started to happen when I started to think about others other than me. And it wasn't much long after that that I read this part in the doctor's opinion, and it kind of struck something to me because I started to think about what is this bifurcation, right? I can be spiritual and also be altruistic. You know, I don't actually. That this whole mindset that I had, because I was working on Wall Street, you know, you get, right? You get. That's what you do. We do all these things in life to get. Or at least I have, right? I'm no Mother Teresa. I'm not choosing the worst shoes out of the bunch so that nobody else has to wear them. You know, made me to start to think about what was my whole mindset. And it was a simple thing that I had asked her. What can, you know, I was complaining about something, and she said, well, why don't you try Steamable Axe? You know, and this stuff comes from people who, you know, it really kind of amazes me to this day that when Bill identified that it was this kind of movement away from self and into altruism, right, that the actual action was the single most important part we could do. And we're now talking about working with others. This is the idea that we're going to get up at a time, you know, certainly back in the day, but we might not want to have gotten up. Somebody might have just been pulled over by the police at midnight and they get called down to the station because they know that you're the only alcoholics in town. This was the way it was back then. But nowadays, you know, we go help a friend or we go to a detox or we do something that we wouldn't normally do. And I'm always positive when I'm busy that if I do that, it's not going to work out for me, right? I'm not going to have a time to do anything else that I'm supposed to do. And inevitably, I have plenty of time to finish all the other things I was supposed to do that day, right? And I ended up coming back from the detox commitment or something else or a 12-step call or a visit to a hospital and go, wow, that kind of worked. Right, and not only did all the other things get done, but I'm at a more spiritual space, a more content space, I'm more aligned with what God wants me to be and what God wants me to do, which is kind of an interesting thing for a guy like me. Let him see that you're not there to instruct him in religion. Admit that he probably knows more about it than you do, but call to his attention the fact that however deep his faith and knowledge, there must be something wrong or he would not drink. Say that perhaps you can help him see where he fails to apply to himself the very precepts he knows so well. For our purpose, you represent no particular faith or denomination. You are dealing only with general principles common to most denominations. Now, this is an interesting set of sentences, right, guys? Because I came in these rooms, and when I was homeless in California, I was homeless when I was 18 in California, it was a great experience. And I lived under a bush, which I found on Google Earth, you know, when Google Earth came out, I went looking for the bush, and I found it. It was on Mission Bay in San Diego. It was a blast. The place where I used to take a shower was still there. It was actually a pretty good time in my life, because I didn't have any money to drink with. And since we had no, you know, if you don't have a phone, it's hard to get a job. Right? If you don't have an address, it's hard for you to get a job. You can't say, I'm living under a bush. You know, will you hire me? So we had to give plasma twice a week. We'd take the bus downtown, give plasma twice a week, and get $9 for that. The bus cost $1.50 round trip, so it was a bit of a hit on our income. But, you know, we lived under the bush and only bought food that could last for 2 days under the bush. And every Wednesday, we went up to the Hare Krishna place because they had free food. And they invite you in, and the food was blue. Some of the food was blue. It was all vegetarian food. It was actually quite good. And I would sit down, and inevitably some guy with a shaved head and a saffron robe would come over and start talking to me. And he was always thin, as I was. I had a better tan than him because I was living on the beach. But he'd come over and say, I want to talk to you about Hare Krishna. And I'd be like, that's so cool, dude. Like, I'm going to listen as long as the food's here, And when I left that experience, I did that for months because we were under the bush for months. And when I left that experience, I left with a very warm feeling about the Hare Krishnas. Right? They were no longer these people who kind of wandered around the airport handing out flowers, or which they don't do anymore because of, the TSA doesn't like that stuff. And they're no longer these people who are kind of different than me. I actually bonded with these guys, because if I didn't want to talk about the Hare Krishnas, they'd say, okay, thank you very much, and they'd go away and the food would still be there. Right? When I came back into the rooms, I started to look at religion at some point, and I had all these reasons why religions didn't work for me. All these reasons. And as time would go by, I would start to see the fallacy in some of my belief structures. Because I would see people who were devout Christians or devout Jews or Muslims living a happy life, happier than I was, right? And in recovery. And I was like, that sucks, And I'm like, I'm never going to be like them. But what I found out was if I gave it some time, I started to really absorb all these wonderful things that were a part of all these different religions. I could actually hear the message that was there that attracted them to that religion, right? And I started to have an understanding about what the world looked like around me outside of my little prejudicial bubble, It was in that that was the evolution that led me to believe that there was something farther down the road. That was the evolution that started to really happen when I started doing Big Book work, because I started to realize what's the line, Chris? We should be quick to see whether others are right? Something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what started to happen for me. And it was this process of this prejudice falling away.
Thanks, Dave. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
There's a couple of good paragraphs that they've read, having to do with placing ourselves in a position to be relatable to whoever we're talking to, and to not alienate. It's very, very important to gain someone's confidence if you're going to be asking them to change their lives, which is what we're going to be doing. Early on, much of the time that these early alcoholics put into their recovery was directly related to their working with others, and they really put their feet to the pavement trying to find people to work with. There weren't meetings like today. If you want to find the still sick and suffering alcoholic, you don't have to look too far. There's meeting books right here. You're going to find a ton of people who are early on and maybe haven't grasped the program of recovery. Maybe they've been half measuring a lot of stuff and haven't become fully convinced that they need what we have and they're willing to go to any lengths to do it. There's also still sick and suffering alcoholics in these rooms that don't really have a clue how sick and suffering they are. They've maintained an adequate sobriety for a period of time and, didn't really see any reason to go past that adequate sobriety. And there's ways that we can be helpful to them too, taking them further down the road with this recovery process. So there's a lot of work to do. We've captured somebody. This is where we are in this chapter. We've captured somebody and they're willing to listen to us. That's where we are. And it says here, outline the program of action, telling how you made a self-appraisal. Outline the 12 steps. Talk about how you did a fourth step. This is when you're 12-stepping somebody. This is what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to throw them in a car, and take them to a meeting. You're supposed to tell them what Alcoholics Anonymous is. Do you want this thing? We're not just going to take you as a hostage somewhere. You know, do you want? This is what it is. Are you willing to do this? Does it look like something that you want to do? Outline the program of action, telling them how you made how you did a four step, how you straightened out your past. Okay, this is what my eighth and my ninth step looked like. I went and I paid the money back. And I went back to the in-laws and the old bosses. And I took care of all the court stuff and all the money that I owed, you know. Explain that to the person. And why you are now endeavoring to be helpful to him. Okay, why am I sitting here talking to you? You're wondering how much this is going to cost or something when I'm done. I am carrying a message of hope and recovery to you, because in so doing, that there's nothing more conducive to immunity from drinking for me than by doing that. So it, you know, by me explaining what it was like, what happened, what it's like today, and trying to engage you, there's nothing I can do that's more potent to keep me away from a drink. And that's one of the reasons I'm doing it. Hey, I'd love to be helpful, but I'm not just doing this because of you. I'm doing this also because it's how I participate in the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Make it plain he's under no obligation to you, that you hope only that he will try to help other alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties. Again, there's no money. You know, we're not dictators here. We're not going to try to take you hostage. This isn't the Moonies or we have a solution for alcoholism that we would like to share with you. And if you want to come with us, you know, we would love to have you. Show how important it is that he place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. Whoa, you know, what a statement. How about that? I thought this was a selfish program. You know, that's what I was hearing when I first came around in 1989. But it says here that he must place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. That is a quantum shift in perspective from where the alcoholic is, because if you're alcoholic, the whole foundation of your life is built on selfishness and self-centeredness, whether you think so or not. That's where alcoholism grows and lives. So the opposite of that is to place the welfare of other people ahead of your own. And there's rational ways to do that. I know Dave pretty well, and I know my own story. We do a lot of stuff over the course of a week that interferes with the things that we would rather be doing. You know what I mean? When I first got sober, there was just basically cable TV, you know, was really in its infancy. Today, I could literally watch 24 hours worth of TV a day and only see great shows. You know what I mean? So like, and that's just one thing I could be doing. I really put a lot into working with others. And as crazy as it sounds, I do it many, many times. I place the welfare of others ahead of my own. Make it clear that he's not under any pressure, that he needn't see you again if he doesn't want to. This is a take it or leave it thing. You should not be offended if he wants to call it off, for he has helped you more than you've helped him. Again, my sharing my experience, strength, and hope with you has benefited me. Thank you for, you know, spending the time with me. And if you don't want this thing, I'd rather know right now if somebody's not interested than after I've taken them to 35 meetings. You know, so that this stuff should be done before you take somebody to a meeting. If your talk has been sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, you have probably made a friend. Maybe you have disturbed him about the question of alcoholism. This is all to the good. Remember, it tells us to talk about the phenomenon of craving, the obsession of the mind, how unmanageability impacts the quality of your life if you're an alcoholic. And if you've talked about the hopelessness and the powerlessness of alcoholism, it may be the first time they've ever heard that. They might have been confused their whole life about why they drink every day and crap their lives up time after time after time. And when you explain it, the phenomenon of craving coupled with the allergy of the body, it may be the first time that they understand how much trouble they're in. And if you've disturbed them in that way, that's all to the good, because maybe their picture of what the hell's going on in their life is a little bit clearer, and they might be more willing to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and do their job and go through the steps. The more hopeless he feels, the better. I love doing 12-step calls on people who have just blown their world up. It's very, very difficult to do a 12-step call on somebody who's been tentatively sober in AA for 10 years. It's hard to 12-step them. It's really easy when, you know, they've just woken up the next day with their third DUI, and the wife is asking them to step out of the house permanently, please. You know, they're very open to a solution at that point in time. You know what I mean? Maybe not this solution, but they're open to a solution. He may be more likely to follow your suggestions when, you know, he's blown his life up. Your candidate may give reasons why he need not follow all of your program. Pay the money back? I never would have stole all that money, Dave, if I knew I was going to have to pay it back. He will rebel at the thought of a drastic house cleaning, which requires discussion with other people. They told me never to admit anything, even if they've got you on video. That's what I learned.
You're doing video one night, right?
Do not contradict such views. Tell him you once felt as he does, but you doubt if you would have made much progress had you not taken action. On your first visit, tell him about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. If he shows interest, lend him your copy of this book. On a 12-step call, always have a big book. I swear to God, folks, before I sponsor anybody, they got to read the big book, and then they have to say, yes, I'm willing, I'm at least willing to be willing to do what it says in this book. Because that's what this is telling me to do. And you know what? Not everybody's going to do that. Four out of five people who say, Chris, would you sponsor me? Like after I give a talk or something, you know, maybe they're kind of inspired or whatever. And I give them a big book and I say, call me when you're done and we'll talk. Four out of five of them don't call me back. And you know what? They're the ones I don't want to call me back because they're going to waste my time. The people who are really willing are going to read the book. They're going to call me back, and there's going to be some traction with that. I'm going to tell a story. This is some experience I had today. I work with a guy. I work with a guy up in New England, and his wife has a daughter who is just listening. In this day and age, folks, with the opiate epidemic and everything, I mean, it gets bad out there with the kids. And this daughter is a crack addict, heroin addict, hanging with the wrong people, shooting gallery apartments. I mean, you get the idea, right? And they have bailed this girl out time and time again, got her another place to live and some money in her pocket and a hot steak dinner and just time after time after time. And it's because of the maternal and paternal instinct. We do not want to see our children suffer. And I had a long, long talk with her today. The daughter was admitted to a psychiatric thing, and that's going to last however long the Medicaid lasts, which is 3 to 5 days or something. And they were going over to clean out the apartment and take everything, because she's being evicted, and take everything and put it into storage for her. and basically what I said was, you're just kicking the can down the road. You know, just let it, don't have anything to do with that. Let her get evicted. Let the stuff get thrown away. You know, tell her the last thing you're going to do is there's a halfway house in New Jersey that we'll get her into, and that's all you're going to do for her. And stop. Just stop. You know, bailing her out. And all it's doing is it's kicking the can down the road a little bit further. You know, she's been told what she needs to do. She's been exposed to 12-step recovery, and she's choosing not to engage in it. You know, allow her the dignity of the consequences of her actions. And it's so difficult for a parent. She'll be sleeping on the street. How do you know that sleeping on the street might not be the bottom? You know, the bottom. So we all have a bottom. Some of us, unfortunately, our bottom is death. But we all have a place where we just are not willing to go any lower. We're not willing to go any lower. And that's what our bottom is. And it's different for each of us. Allow her the space for that bottom. Because every time you bail her out and give her three hots and a cot, you're just allowing this whole thing to have another life, you know? And those are difficult conversations to have with parents. So, sometimes they'll yes you, yeah, and then go bail them out because of that maternal, paternal instinct. But we folks, we have a take-it-or-leave-it program here. This is what we have. Not everybody is going to choose this. There are people who would rather die than go to AA meetings. They would rather die than go to AA meetings. There are people out there that are set up to help those people. There are professionals. There are treatment people. There are social workers. There are hospitals. But what we have here is we have a solution. We have a solution that we can all agree on. This works. You know, so what we try to do is we try to share our experience with this solution. Offer it up. And then it's take it or leave it. Unless your friend wants to talk further about himself, do not wear out your welcome. Give him a chance to think it over. If you do stay, let him steer the conversation in any direction he likes. Sometimes a new man is anxious to make a decision and discuss his affairs at once, and you may be tempted to let him proceed. This is different. This makes more sense than it does in the big book. The person may want to do a third step right there the first time you talk, before he's even read the big book, and then start sharing their fifth step with you right then and there, the first time you're talking with them, before they've even read a big book. And what they're saying here is this may be a mistake to allow it to move this quickly. This is almost always a mistake. If he has trouble later, he's likely to say you rushed him. You will be most successful with alcoholics if you do not exhibit any passion for crusade or reform. Never talk down to an alcoholic from any moral or spiritual hilltop. Simply lay out your kit of spiritual tools for his inspection. And I really, really try not to do this. I really try to talk, you know, one-on-one, peer-to-peer with any alcoholic, anytime I'm talking with them, even my sponsees. Peer-to-peer. I'm sorry, I'm not the type of sponsor who wants to lord it over you and, you know, give you minute instructions in how you must live your life. That's not me. And also, when I'm talking to a still sick and suffering alcoholic, I also try to talk eye-to-eye with them. Because really, there but for the grace of God, am I. And maybe I'm a little bit further along into the solution than they are, but that doesn't make me any better than they are. You know, it just, maybe it makes me a little more useful. And laying out the kit of spiritual tools, we're supposed to do this in the first or the second visit. What are the spiritual tools? The 12 steps. What's happened over the course of the last 50 years is because so many meetings have popped up. You cannot shake a stick without hitting an AA meeting. We have gotten lazy. And we've started to use the meetings of AA as something other than our one-on-one face-to-face work. We don't do as much one-on-one face-to-face work, and we do a lot more fellowshipping in the meetings. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I love the fellowship. I love that I can't shake a stick without hitting an AA meeting because this is where I feel the most comfortable. But just because a still sick and suffering alcoholic shows up in Alcoholics Anonymous does not mean that this simple kit of spiritual tools is laid at their feet and they are 12-step. It was years in Alcoholics Anonymous before someone did a full-blown 12-step call on me. I was sober about 2 years, and this guy Foster, who got sober in 1959, invited me over to his house to do some bad electrical work, because I was a bad electrician. And halfway through this electrical work, I realized he didn't have me over there to do the electrical work. He had me over there because he was telling me his story, and he was allowing me to tell him mine. And he was doing what it said in this book. He was an old school alcoholic from the 50s, and back in the 50s they did a more accurate run through the steps than we started to do when the treatment centers started to dump people into our fellowship like 50 a day. So it was old school, hardcore, you know, big book style 12-step call, and I only realized it at the end what he was trying to do, and that was 2 years in. You know, I heard a lot of people's stories and I heard a lot of stuff in the meetings, but no one ever sat me down and traded, you know, our experience together. And that was amazing. Show him how they worked with you. This is how the steps worked with me. This is what the fourth step did. I learned some deep truths about, you know, my stock and trade. This is what the fifth step did. It offered me some freedom and some transparency and legitimacy. You know, here, this is what the ninth step did. It made me able to walk down any street in New Jersey free of any worry about bumping into somebody because I'd straightened out everything I possibly could. This is what the steps did for me. And they offered me a solution for that obsession of the mind. I was placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected from alcohol. Alcohol was not going to end up back in my body and hasn't ended up back in my body. And this is what the steps have done for me. Offer him friendship and fellowship. Tell him that if he wants to get well, you would do anything to help. We will do anything for the willing alcoholic. But listen to this next paragraph. If he is not interested in your solution, if he does not understand or does not want to engage in a spiritual recovery program, which includes the 12 steps, if he expects you to act only as a banker for his financial difficulties or a nurse for his sprees or a coach for his drama, drop him until he changes his mind. This is different than the big book. It says, drop him. If they are not willing to work the steps with you, there's the door. You know, be friendly, be non-shaming, but make it very, very clear that your time is incredibly valuable. There's only one solution that we all agree on, and that's the 12 steps. And if they're not willing to engage in those 12 steps, you're not only wasting your time, you're wasting theirs. You're kicking the can down the road like those parents were doing with their daughter. This he may do after he gets hurt again. So, what is that saying? Is that saying let them go back out and drink again? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. If they're not willing to take the steps, they're probably going to drink again anyway. And you're not going to have much to do with that decision. But you've shared with them the solution. Maybe after one more drunk, they'll come back with a renewed sense of enthusiasm as far as the recovery process. Right, Dave?
You think?
I don't know. I'm just guessing.
I got to push back on one thing that Chris said. You know, he says that, you know, he has this, you know, Chris is my sponsor. He says that he has this kind of one-on-one relationship with his sponsees, and, you know, he doesn't take any moral high road or anything, but, you know, I just want to point something out. You know, I met him, I asked him in 2009 to sponsor me, and I got to know him over the years, and he always made mention to me, you know, I'm a minister. I could marry you if you were ever getting married. Oddly enough, in 2016, I decided to get remarried, right? So I said, Chris, you wanna marry us? And he said, yeah. Were the first ones that you married?
The only ones.
The only ones, yeah. So he was kind enough and nice enough to send us a template for our vows, which I mean, if you ever thought about it, it's kind of hard to write. And we said, okay, Chris, thank you very much for the vows. He goes, how do you want to be identified in these vows? He goes, Your Eminence.
I am a doctor of divinity. Folks, it costs $5 on the internet, I swear. It was quite a sacrifice.
And the interesting thing about this is, after Chris married us, I was like, I want to become a minister. I've actually got a card. It doesn't get you onto the plane any faster when you're traveling, but I became a minister, and a guy in our lineage asked me to marry him, and I married him in his girlfriend down in New Orleans, and I had a blast. So I've done it once.
You got the robes, too.
I got the robes. I put the robes.
I don't have the robes.
I'll get to them for Christmas. One of the other interesting things, too, what was his name from Cleveland? The early
Clarence Snyder?
Clarence Snyder, thank you. I kept thinking Sydney, but no. Clarence Snyder was an active alcoholic in the 30s. He was one of the original people to get sober. He would drive down from Cleveland, right? And eventually what ended up happening was the meeting in Akron got too big for the house. And Clarence, and I guess he had about six people in tow at the time, probably 36 maybe, right? 1936, maybe 37. They decided they were just going to have their meetings in Cleveland. So they went up to Cleveland and they started having their meetings. And they didn't drive down to Akron except maybe every once in a while and hug up. And there was about six of them. And what ended up happening was Clarence was this massively enthusiastic alcoholic. You'll see them in Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes, and they're just out doing the deal all the time. And he was a tad nuts. And the Cleveland Plains Dealer wrote a series of articles, four articles over the course of a month, once a week for 1 month, talking about people who were cured of alcoholism. And they mentioned Clarence's name and a couple other people. And what ended up happening was they were inundated with phone calls. You know, concerned wives, ministers, lawyers, judges. Can you help Bob? Bob's having a hard time. So what used to be when somebody would end up in the hospital and Clarence and his six disciples would run into the hospital and all kind of 12-step this guy together over the course of a day or two, like one group would show up and another group would show up. They were so inundated with calls that they could no longer do that. It'd be one guy who went to the hospital, right? So you guys are doing the hospital on the south side tonight, and they were all out running around talking to these people. And it's kind of, some people think that this is kind of where the idea of sponsorship came from, where it was just a single person, because Bill and Bob showed up together, you know, to 12-step, Bill Dotson, AA number 3. And it was always this kind of thing, you grab all your buddies in AA and go 12-step somebody. Well, what ends up happening, right, is because Clarence Snyder is out running around doing all stuff. They have no time for people who don't want to hear this message. They had become incredibly... In fact, AA in Cleveland took off so much that for several years after that, people thought AA started in Cleveland, even though it was an offshoot meeting 2 years after Alcoholics Anonymous started in Akron, because they were so vibrant there as a community. But they had no time to waste with anybody. And that's one of the hardest things that I've ever had to deal with, because I don't know about you, but I want to claim somebody. I want to take somebody hostage as a successful sponsee. Nobody wants your sponsee to go out and drink on you. And you certainly don't want someone to come to your meeting and say, are you working with Bob?
Is Bob yours?
Well, which Bob? You know, I remember in like 1985, I had been out of rehab for a couple of months. Maybe it was early 86, and I had one sponsee, and he was precious to me. And he stopped. I would call him, you know, and he didn't have to call me. Like, what are you up to? And finally, he goes, "Listen, I don't want you to call me anymore." You know, Christ, I can't even keep these guys. But I would learn really through this kind of hard work. Exactly what Chris said. Like, if you're sitting across from somebody, if somebody shows up and you're doing the deal and you're walking them through the insanity of the first step, what a manageability looks like, right? It's actually not them, it's you, right? This whole thing. And you walk them right through till you get to the third step and you start talking about, you know, turning your will and your life under the care of God. And they're going, "Whoa, well, hold on. Let's talk about that for a minute, because I'm not sure I can do that," right? If you've made an adequate presentation up until that point, I have always found it's worthy of approaching that from a couple different sides, but if you get it from the table and they're still hemming and hawing, it's best to say, "Let me know what you want to do." Right? Because there's nothing better than for somebody to wake up with the terrible bewilderment, you know, remorse and shame of another drink if it doesn't kill them. Right? To have them give another thought to the idea of God. And I'll tell you this, when I was 17 years sober and drank again, right? I spent the next 2 years wanting to stick a gun in my mouth totally sober. I'm going to get with God. Took me 7 more years, right? Because I'm resistant, right? I'm a fighter till the end, right? But leaving them alone, right? While being helpful, known to be helpful, known to be the guy that you want to be like. You know, when I met Chris, I did a, you know, Chris is the guy who walked into a meeting and gave a nice pitch about what his life looked like. And he wasn't giving a pitch about, like, I'm here. He was just talking about his life. And the person that was speaking from that podium was happy where they were at. How many times have you rolled through a meeting and realized that nobody's happy where they're at? Everyone wants a better job, a new girlfriend, or a new boyfriend, or a new car, or something, right? They want something other than where they're at. And Chris was happy where he was at. So I did what every good alcoholic does, is I asked for his number, then didn't call him for a long time. And I was not even sponsored at the time, right? I was sponsored by me, which is not sponsored. And I would call him every once in a while when I knew he couldn't answer. But eventually I made the mistake of calling, and he picked up the phone. And I said, "Let's go through the steps." And once into that process, in a willing state, I started to shed this idea that I was separate from you guys. I started to shed this idea that I was not a child of God. I started to shed this idea that I could manage and control my life in everything but alcoholism. Right? That was the shedding. That was the true first step as it started to happen. Right? I thought I could manage and control everybody else. As long as it wasn't alcohol, I was fine. That was not the case. The idea that I can manage and control my life has been persistent up until... I knew about it, wanted to hold on to it, up until I could no longer hold on to it anymore. I couldn't be in here and hold on to it anymore. I couldn't be a member of this fellowship actually involved in the steps and working with others and hold on to it anymore. I was in here and I was unhappy. Because no matter how thin I made that holding on to something, I'm going to let God run the show when it comes to work, right? Isn't that nice of me to give up power to God? God, thank you very much. You can have this one, right? This idea that I can give stuff up to God on a piece-by-piece basis and it'll be okay doesn't actually work in my life. But it was the best I could do until I actually became willing. And the interesting thing about it and the amazing thing about it for me is that that was exactly what I was supposed to go through, right? It's the willingness. And Chris talked about it. He also said it very well, too, about at least you're willing to be willing. One of the most annoying things that has ever happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in this parking lot. Chris had been sponsoring me for a year and a half or 2 years, and I said, "I'm not going to do that." He goes, "Well, would you be willing to do that?" I go, "No, I'm not willing to do that." He goes, "Would you be willing to be willing to do that?" I go, "No, I would not be willing to be willing to do that." He goes, "Would you be willing to be willing to be willing to do that?" I go, "This shit's never going to end. Never going to end." I go, "Sure. If it's 3 levels deep, I'm in the game." And the funny thing was, I just did it, right? But I had this idea that I was attached. I had to manage and control my life in some area, right? It's the pushback that we get You're sitting across from the guy. You're trying to take him through the third step. You're trying to get an idea of whether he's willing. He has no idea what he's talking about. If he's new to Alcoholics Anonymous, he has no idea. No idea. I had no idea after being here 20-plus years. No idea that it was in every other aspect of my life. If he is sincerely interested and wants to see you again, ask him to be sure to read this book in the interval. After doing that, he is to decide for himself whether he wants to go on. Of course, just to point out, there was no book when he wrote that. He is not to be pushed or prodded by you, his wife, or his friends. If he is to find God, the desire must come from within. And that's a pretty powerful statement, right? I have come to the realization, at least in my life, that God has never been lost, right? It's like standing, you know, have you ever like walked around some like your house going, can't find my glasses. Well, my glasses, right? That's my experience with God. I had never lost God. I just didn't realize that God had been there the entire time. So if that's the case, what's got to happen? I've got to change. God's not got to return, right? And of course, that desire has to start within me, right? It can't start outside of me because no change actually of any value has ever started outside of me. If he thinks he can do the job in some other way or prefers some other spiritual approach, encourage him to follow his own conscience. You have no monopoly on God. You merely have an approach that worked with you, but point out that we alcoholics have much in common and that you would like, in any case, to be friendly. Let it go at that. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You're sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. It's a waste of time and poor strategy to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. You know, there's an individual who's a good friend of mine. He lives in Manhattan. He's kind of like much younger than me. And he had asked me to do some work with him. And we spent a year and a half doing work, doing spiritual work. And it was a blast. I had a great time. Near the end of it, though, we were both getting a little frustrated. Right? And what ended up happening was that we both kind of came to the realization that his approach to me, he was trying to fix something else. Some other part of his spiritual life that was amiss, and he was trying to use Alcoholics Anonymous to do that. And it was helpful, but it wasn't the solution. Right? And if I had known more, if I had more experience, it wasn't until I had that experience with him that I could turn to somebody else in these rooms who might approach me and ask about something. Could I tell them then, maybe you want to try some other avenue, some other path, some other way to see if that works better for you, because my experience with that particular thing is it doesn't work, right? We don't have that monopoly, right? I know people, right, who drank as heavily as I did and had all the outward markings of alcoholism, but in the end, when they decided to get sober, they found something that worked for them. And have gone on to be happier. I've seen people do it with physical exercise. And I'm not talking about, you know, Joe left AA last month and he's a trainer now, right? You know, and he looks great, he's buff. Now I'm talking about a guy who basically 20 years ago said, you know, I'm really kind of finding myself in this regimen that I'm doing, you know, with martial arts, and he doesn't drink anymore and he's happy. Right? That's not going to work for me. Right? It might work for him. That's cool. Right? I've seen people go out and find religion. I've seen people go out and find other things. I've seen other people embrace that. But if you suffer from alcoholism of the type that I suffer from, then we've got some work to do. Right? We've got some work to do. Because this stuff just doesn't end, right, with a good with actually paying for a gym membership and showing up.
Absolutely. We can finish if you want.
Well, yeah. I actually skipped over a couple of lines in that paragraph. I thought you might want to expand on. I left that dangling flow fruit for you.
It's a waste of time and poor strategy to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. I did this for years in the early days. I remember throwing a ladder up onto a third-story window to drag somebody out to a meeting. I mean, You know, I made every mistake in the world. Every mistake in the world doing this 12-step work because I had no guidebook. I was just winging it at that point in time. I was putting more effort into someone's sobriety than they were. And that's a recipe for disaster right there. If they're not working harder than you are, you know, there's a problem. If you leave such a person alone, in all likelihood, he will begin to run after you, for he will soon become convinced that he cannot recover alone. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. This is hard for a lot of us. We become close to some of these knuckleheads that we're working with, and we don't want to just drop them, right? Because we care for them. But this book is telling us our time is valuable, and it should be focused on people who are willing to work the steps. That's who it should be focused on. And it's hard because I'll tell you, there's two guys that I never gave up on, and I should have the first time they relapsed. And it's because I love these guys. I knew them both in high school. I went to school with both of these guys. You know, we had a history. We grew up together. And I would not give up on him. One of them's dead. He died sober. The other is still in what I would describe as shows improvement, you know, from the forward, which means that there's a lot of dry time and then colossal bender, you know, destruction, you know, detox with a following a period of time where he's sober. And his issue is he will not believe in God. He will not believe that there's a power greater than himself. And that's a sticking point for him. He's the intellectually prideful type. But I'll always take his call and I'll always help him. And I know it's wrong. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to do it anyway because I friggin' love this guy. One of our fellowship failed entirely with his first half dozen prospects. He often says that if he had continued to work on them, he might have deprived many others who have since recovered of their chance. So, you know, again, we try to find the people. So many times in this book it says, willing to go to any lengths. We need to offer them the dignity of what those willing to go to any... What is any lengths? Okay, Dave, are you willing to go to any lengths? You know, without offering them a definition of what those any lengths is. We're supposed to be offering them a definition of what those any lengths are. Are you willing to do? Are you willing to be willing to do this? Because I'll tell you what, if you put one foot in front of the other and start taking the next required action in this program of recovery, there's nothing I can do but help you. I mean, it's organic as part of my nature. Having an awakened spirit, it's organic to walk people through this process. And that finishes up that paragraph, Dave.
Thank you, Your Eminence. All right. Meeting's open.